Well, I sent out an email a few weeks ago to prepare for this Sabbath and ask for people to respond. And it was incredible. I heard from people all over the country responding to this devilish subject. All kinds of responses came in. I've picked just a few to share with you, little portions. Because my subject, in case you haven't read the bulletin, is If I Were the Devil, Top 10 Ways to Stop Church Growth. If I Were the Devil. And no jokes about how easy this is for me to get into this. My wife has already been all over that this week, so leave it with her. She says it comes quite naturally for me. But here is someone who said, I find that the devil uses most effectively his tools of discouragement, doubt, and distrust. See, as a preacher, I love that three D's, you know, the discouragement, doubt, and distrust. All he has to do to shake up the good guys is to have someone say unkind things about them, and ultimately they spend all their time trying to erase the damage, which is impossible and better left alone. Then there's always the no one at the church was friendly to me, so I left. Or how about, why does she or he have to be up front all the time? Criticism is the knife that rips the stoutest heart into pieces, especially when it comes from those we expect to love us. Satan really doesn't have to do all that much to derail us. Our sinful nature laps up negativity like a thirsty animal laps from the water spring. That lady is quite gifted with words. Or how about this one? Succinct bullet points. If you're looking for items to add to your list, and then this particular author gave me 4 or 5. Thinking programs will fix the church. Confusing traditions / practices for core issues. Resisting generational changes. Insisting on uniformity. And missing the love of God. Or here's one from a real estate client of mine in California. Installing a pastor of any church who does not have the gift to teach nor have the love for his sheep would be Satan's joy. Well put. Another one. If I were the devil, I'd, parenthesis, be laughing all the way to the bank, and I would never challenge a Christian directly, but would just keep him busy with stuff or work or relationships or sports or entertainment or life. Wouldn't need 9 more ways because it's too easy to keep them otherwise occupied. And then here's another one sent from his iPhone. I would convince people that the purpose of the church was for their entertainment and to make them feel comfortable. I would also make people feel uncomfortable around others not like them. So the sinners wouldn't feel God's love through his people, but would be judged instead. That's my 2 cents and my greatest fear for the church. And then another one. I'd keep God's people stuck in Adventist angst. What's Adventist angst? I'd see to it that they nursed past hurts and obsessed over offenses of yesteryear to the point that they couldn't move on and grow in Christ. As they insist on lamenting the legalism that was, they will harden their hearts to the grace that is and will remain prisoners of the ghosts of Adventism past. Wow. I'd never let them see the true beauty of the Adventist message as it is in Jesus, nor let them taste and see that the Lord is good. That's my 2 cents. Preach the word. This is from another pastor. And then I close with this one. This section, I'm not done. Good subject. God be with you. I know the devil doesn't want us to think about that. I'm not sure if what I say will help since it's been almost 4 years since I've gone to church. And I just now realize how the time has gone by. When I thought about why I haven't been, all I could come up with was lame excuses. And this last year, I haven't even bothered with any excuses. The excuses that got me where I am were, I'm too tired, it was a rough week at work, I gain weight and I can't fit into my Sabbath clothes, I've had to travel so much with work or care for elderly parents, I just want to stay home. I think I'm going to stay home and enjoy the beautiful weather and God's creation instead of sit in church. I think I'm getting a cold. I don't want to expose others to my germs. But when you take away all the excuses, the one thing that's obvious is that there are a lot of diversions in our life. And if you're not anchored, you can get swept away from the community of the church. Wow. Wow. If I were the devil, I wouldn't waste much time in the bars and the brothels. You know where I'd focus my efforts? In the church. Yeah. Especially churches where God is being accurately portrayed and good things are happening. That's where I would focus. Now, individually, we know this is true because we've all seen it in our experience. Step up to the plate and do something out of the ordinary, great for God, something you haven't tried before, and I promise you one thing, all hell will break loose. Have you ever noticed that? It happens again and again. And you wonder why? Well, we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, but against... And it's the same thing in a church. Even a church like Cloverdale. Rock along with the same old, same old, same old. No big issues. But when a critical mass of members prayerfully starts to push the battle forward, then you better watch out. You better be alert and of sober mind because your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith because you know that the family of believers throughout the world is undergoing the same kind of sufferings. So with that warning and with a little credit to C.S. Lewis and David Letterman, I've never put those two names in the same sentence before. Here we go. If I were the devil, top 10 ways to stop church growth. This is a letter from Satan. Number 10, don't, by all means, don't study what other successful churches are doing. Don't pay any attention to that, especially if they're not of your own denomination. Just ignore what others are doing and spend all of your available time and energy plodding on forward like a horse with blinders on. No vision. No vision. Just keep doing what you've always done in the same way you've always done it because change is too hard anyway. Especially as we get older. Terry. If you do venture out to take a peek, limit your peeking to the mega churches like Willow Creek in Chicago and Saddleback in California. Huge churches like that so that you can come back from those experiences somewhat overwhelmed and dazed and even a bit discouraged because it seems so far from where you experience church life that it just seems unattainable, kind of like broad jumping across the Grand Canyon. Please don't look around the Boise area. Oh, no learning things from successful churches here. Now that scares me. Please keep the blinders on. Remember, no vision. Now by successful, I'm talking about three things that really trouble me if I'm the devil. Three things that successful churches are doing. Number one, true conversions. Number two, maturing disciples. And number three, selfless acts of service that advance the gospel message. Now, where that's happening, that's a real problem for me, if I'm the devil. A lot of what the churches are doing these days doesn't really bother me at all. I'm okay with it. Most of it, in fact. In fact, I'll let you in on a little secret. The church, you know what? The church can be the greatest conspiracy against God that there ever was. It can actually do my cause the most benefit and his the most harm. Yeah. But the ones that are successful, that are making a difference in the battle, that's where I have to work the hardest, and I try not to have people notice and copy what they're doing. Number 9. If I'm the devil and I want to stop church growth, there is one thing that I want you to focus on like a laser. You know what it is? It is money. 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 Did you hear me? Money. Make that the measuring stick by which everyone and everything is judged. I don't care how you do it, but some way make sure that financial pressures squeeze out all the life and fun of the church. You know, nothing sucks out all the oxygen in the air like not being able to pay your bills. Yeah. So, somehow, some way, make sure this message comes through loud and clear in church every Sabbath. The church is broke and desperately in need of cash. Now, I know this is a tough one to sell, because my enemy, well, he owns everything. Do you know that it would be possible for my enemy to stack up a stack of gold bricks all around this platform in the next 2 seconds that would be so high that I, if I'm the devil, could hide behind the brick gold wall? True or false? It'd just be a snap of his fingers. He could do it. I know he could do it. But if I am the devil, I have a lot of ways to make sure that the church forgets this fact. And I really hate it when the momentum gets going and God's people step up to the line like they did in Exodus 36, 3 through 7. Oh, this troubles me. And the people continued to bring free will offerings morning after morning. So all the skilled craftsmen who were doing all the work on the sanctuary left their work and said to Moses, "The people are bringing more than enough for doing the work the Lord commanded to be done." Then Moses, what did he have to do? He gave an order and they sent this word throughout the camp. No man or woman is to make anything else as an offering for the sanctuary. And so the people were restrained from bringing more because what they already had was more than enough to do all the work. Can you believe it? An announcement in church? No more offerings. We've already got too much. We've been able to put 10 new roofs on the school. I mean, that would be incredible. If I were the devil, I would work to see that this kind of spiritual momentum never gets going. Mm-mm. Can't have it. Number 8. Minimize prayer and keep it very dry and formal. Jesus, my enemy, said, "My house shall be called a house of prayer." Now that bothers me if I'm the devil. If I'm the devil, I want to make sure that this house is called a house of anything except prayer. A house of preaching, great preaching. A house of great music, a house of great fellowship, a house of great food, a house of great fun. I don't care what you fill in the blank with, as long as it isn't prayer. That one really bothers me. So whatever it takes, I would work to get the church's attention off prayer. Focus on plans, focus on programs, focus on problems, focus on anything except prayer. Now, I'm quite aware of the fact that I won't be able to totally eliminate prayer from the church and from Christians' lives, so here's my strategy. In church, I'm going to try to get people to spend most of the time on other things, and when we do pray, we're going to make them long and formal. We're going to make it so that no one can really even get up and pray in church except the elderly saints who know how to say all the right words and repeat the same old phrases, because that way no one's even going to be listening anyway. You know the phrases. Let's see, missionaries and call porters. You ever heard that one? Or those who can't be here today. I mean, how many million times have we prayed for those who can't be here today? You know? You fill in the blanks. Whatever it is that's been said so often and in the same way so many times that you don't even hear it anymore. If I'm the devil, I love it when that happens. Oh, but when a sincere Christian gets up and opens their heart and really talks to God and touches his heart with honest transparency, that scares me. Number 7. Make worship services embarrassing and boring. Make church worship a true test of the endurance of the saints. And I mean endurance. See how long you can go. And most importantly, make it boring. Be sure and read all the announcements from the bulletin because somebody might miss one. And don't use the latest communication technology during the week. No, by all means, don't do that. Make the services drag on and on and on with long time delays. And now here's one of my favorites, especially for Seventh-day Adventist churches. And I better take off my jacket because we're getting going now. Make the parents with infants and small children suffer like you had to suffer when you had small children. And if they're going to run the gauntlet of getting everyone ready and even coming to church, make it tough for them. Don't provide a professionally staffed and secure nursery and program for children. No, it's good training to have them all learn to endure. Remember, endurance, that's the key word here. Endurance. Make them all learn to endure in the sanctuary. Never mind what the other evangelical growing churches are doing. Just ignore that fact. Maintain the status quo of what you experienced as a child at all costs. Now I've got more. Is it okay if I go on? I'm the devil, remember? Keep everything very dark and very drab. Make sure there's poor lighting and lots of burned out bulbs. Yesterday's technology everywhere. And speaking of lighting, I hate light. Keep everything poorly lit out on the street so that for any program happening here at night, people will think that there is a cemetery on both sides of Cloverdale Avenue. If I were the devil, that's what I would do. Whatever it takes. My point here is just make sure that the members don't really feel excited or even comfortable in inviting their friends. Anything that can be done to make services awkward, embarrassing, and boring, I'm all in for that. You want to see the devil smile? You know the old joke about the man who said that his soldier friend had died in the service and someone asked him which one? Was it the early morning, 9 o'clock, or the 11 o'clock hour? That always brings a smile to my face if I'm the devil. I love that story. Number 6. If I'm the devil and I want to stop church growth, I would see to it that the church majors in minor lifestyle issues. Keep the focus there. I just love it when I see the church all consumed with things that don't really matter. It's fabulous. Major in minors and minor in majors. That's my motto. Whatever it was that you were taught as a child that it's really important to do, if you're a Christian, make sure that everyone else in the church measures up to that same standard. After all, good Christians can't just fill in the blanks. If I were the devil, I wouldn't care too much about how the blanks are filled in. I'd just make sure that you've got a list and it's a long one. And we're enforcing it on each other, right? For quite a few years, here's what one of my most successful mottos for Christians was. If it looks good, don't wear it. If it tastes good, spit it out. And if you enjoy it, stop it. Now, that worked for quite a while, but I have others. And in fact, when this one loses all of its punch, I can accomplish my purpose and come from the totally opposite direction. Do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. There's no absolutes. It's all about relationships. Nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat, drink, and be glad. I got a wise man to say that 3,000 years ago, and it's even in the Bible. Anyway, when it comes to the church, I love to see this tension played out in the members. This false dichotomy between behaviorism and relationship, it is so phony. I'm the devil. I know all about what a relationship leads to in terms of behavioral changes. It's a principle that I use all the time. But don't tell Christians that. I prefer it when I can get everyone arguing about the theory. Then we can just stop even simple things that would make a difference. Let's get back to arguing about our lists. Do I dare be specific? Do I dare give you another example? Of course I do. Remember, I'm the devil. Refreshment bar in the lobby? Are you kidding me? I hate to see a corner of the foyer turned into anything that even slightly resembles a coffee shop. That might promote too much fellowship and an opportunity to connect with new people. Heaven help me. Speaking of lists, majoring in minor lifestyle issues, It really bothers me when I see churches quietly educate and promote God's ideal while avoiding battles over some of the smaller and debatable deep details. So much of it just really doesn't matter, but don't tell Christians that. Number five, keep young adults on the sidelines. Make sure that the old gray-haired men like Jerry and Randy and Don and Tom and make all the important decisions and strategic plans for the church. After all, they know best. And you do know that it's the old people that give most of the money. Yeah. See, there's a little connection here. Yeah. You can't afford to offend them. And hopefully, the church won't notice that, generally speaking, I have the most trouble when the children, youth, and young people are on fire for God. When young pastors team up with young families and people of similar age and energy. Now, that's what really causes me trouble. And in case you haven't forgotten, I hate to mention this, but the Seventh-day Adventist Church was founded by very young Christians. Most of the leaders were in their 20s and 30s, men and women. Can you believe it? Now look at the average age of the leadership. What has happened? I've been so successful, and the leaders, especially in the upper levels of the church, the General Conference, the North American Division, the Union Conferences, are now mostly elderly men. Yeah. I love all those layers of administration. It's wonderful for me. You know why? It helps to drain the local churches of much of the best leadership talent and financial resources. It is working perfectly for me. Thank you very much. And also, fortunate for me, most of the women who have a passion for God and leadership gifts from my enemy, they've been shut out. Sidelined, ignored by the churches and the young adults, well, they can just wait for their turn when they become elderly. If I'm the devil, I like it when I see churches that have gone through the organizational cycles of growth and maturity and that are now in decline, just struggling to hang on. Check out the median age of a church. And when it gets up into the 50s and 60s, I don't have to worry about it anymore. They're too tired to cause me much trouble. Do I dare go on? Number four, stir up trouble. If I were the devil at some point, if I were really concerned about what's happening at Cloverdale, I'd pull out my big guns and start to fire away. What are my really big guns? Well, I prefer to keep them a secret, but I guess I'm pretty confident. I'm like the poker players playing with the hand face up. Here they are. Pride, prestige, and pretense. Pride, pretense, or the lust for prestige, should I say. Luke chapter 9, verse 46, under the heading, "Who will be the greatest?" Are you shocked that I know the Bible? Know it better than you do. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For he who is the least among you all, he is the greatest." "Master," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he's not one of us." Well, now, am I understanding that? What exactly is the problem here? I'm the devil. I'm getting expelled from somebody's life. Demons are being driven out, but the disciples are concerned because it's being done by someone outside of their little group. Is that what's going on here? If I'm the devil, I love this kind of thinking because it feels really good to me. In fact, it's right in my sweet spot. Thank you very much. Something that doesn't feel quite as good to me, I saw in the Adventist Review just a couple weeks ago. Wish it hadn't been printed. There was a quote from a Christian pastor by the name of Tozer. Goodness, he died 50 years ago, but I can't seem to keep people from reading his stuff. I really hate it. It's this book, The Pursuit of God. Oh, this one really bothers me. "The labor of self-love is a heavy one indeed. As long as you set yourself up as a little god to which you must be loyal, there will be those who will delight to offer affront to your idol. The heart's fierce effort to protect itself from every slight, to shield its touchy honor from the bad opinion of friend and enemy, will never let the mind rest. They have placed someone else before you. They have whispered that you're pretty small stuff after all. And now you feel hurt because the world is saying about you the very things that you've been saying about yourself. Only yesterday you were telling God that you were nothing, a mere worm of the dust. Come on, humble yourself and cease to care what men think." Wow. When the battle really gets serious, if I'm the devil, I can almost count on stirring up trouble to stop the church from growing. And the three P's are my favorite bullets: pride, pretense, and the lust of prestige. And then if I can get the trouble stirring and rolling in the church, I keep pouring on the gasoline on the fire. And do you want to know what the gasoline is? Criticism. Criticism. I just love it when that word rolls off my lips. Criticism. Be critical of anything and everything. There's nothing like a good dose of criticism to take the energy away from anyone who is attempting to do something for God. So whenever you see that, be sure and pour on criticism. It doesn't even have to be related to the subject at hand. Just find anything you can to be critical of. Their work, their clothes, their children, their car, their house, their physique. They're too tall, they're too short, they're too fat, they're too skinny. Doesn't matter. Pick, pick, pick. And then top it off with a little juicy gossip that nobody else knows. Doesn't even have to be true. Just make it up if you need to. The more bizarre, the better. We are rolling now. Okay? Number three. Ah, love this one. Let's have a war in church. Let's battle about music and worship style. I have used this one for centuries, and it's been most effective. It always helps to stir up trouble. Don't pay any attention to the target audience in contemporary culture. Just be sure when it comes to the music and worship style that you please the older members of the congregation, or they might stop coming. In fact, do everything to please, say, people in their 60s and 70s who grew up in the church and spent all their life being educated in church schools. And you know what I really hated? I really hated this Adventist church that I heard about a few months ago in Fresno, California. It just made me sick to my stomach. They had a worship format that really troubled me. You know why? The service started with a big organ anthem that was fantastically well done, and it connected everyone, the young people and the old people, with the rich hymn heritage of the church. Then there was a snappy welcome and one well-voiced announcement, followed by a very upbeat worship band with contemporary praise music. And during the music, they seemed to be talking directly to my enemy, God. Yeah, they weren't just singing about Him. They were singing to Him, directly to Him through the music. In fact, it became really an extended time of prayer. Many of the songs were really just prayers that were being sung straight to God. And the last time that I checked, the people there were really connecting with the Creator during the worship service. And if I were the devil, I would hope that this doesn't catch on. Because I love it when church is fighting about worship instead of worshiping. And I love it when there are no other worship options for worship times than the 11 o'clock hour, even in big city churches. Oh, I hope Cloverdale doesn't even think of having a Friday evening service and two on Sabbath morning and one in the afternoon to fill this place four times. Keep everybody together at the same time in the same room. It sounds so good, and it helps me stop church growth. I love it. Number two. No testimonies. As long as I can keep it, so only the paid professionals of the church do most of the talking up front, I think we'll be okay. Now, my preference would be to still have everything in Latin, including Pastor Jim's sermons. It troubles me a little bit that they're so short, sweet, to the point, and people can really understand what he's trying to say. But if we're not going to be able to move it back to Latin, then let's just make sure that the only one who can speak up front, by and large, are the paid professionals. Now, what I fear, if I'm the devil, is testimony. You think I'm deaf? You think I didn't hear the loud voice in heaven say they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony? And you want to know who the him is? Who's the him? It's me. It's me. I know the book of Revelation better than you do. I know it by memory. And I know from personal experience how important it is to squelch testimonies, especially the kind that is fresh, honest, short, sweet, and to the point. It really troubles me when ordinary people get a chance to tell their story in church, the story of what my enemy Jesus has done in their life. Ouch, stop it, please. Don't let this happen. Well, it's not a problem. Because fortunately for me, most churches don't allow it. And when they do, I've got some countermeasures. I've had hundreds and thousands of years to develop this, so you don't think I'm going to be caught unawares. I've perfected these countermeasures. I try and squelch testimony by making sure that the testimony is so long and rambling that nobody listens, and it's kind of awkward and embarrassing. Or another tactic that I use is I get the person who's sharing the testimony to glamorize their BC life so much that everybody leaves wanting a little bit of that. I mean, it was so incredible. They spend 5 minutes of their testimony talking about what it was like before Christ and about 10 seconds afterwards. And, you know, I can handle that okay. What really hurts me are the well-prepared testimonies that focus on the power of God to change lives from hopelessness and despair to joy and peace. That makes me cringe so much that I can't even stay in the church. And if that is accompanied by some real prayer, I have to get out of there immediately. I have no other option. Finally, number one. What's number one? The most important thing that I would do if I were the devil to stop church growth at Cloverdale is this. I would do everything I can to help us to lose our sense of mission, vision. Remember, we're talking about vision. opening eyes and shutting eyes. Focus inward. My favorite tactic, if I'm the devil, is to make Christians think that the church is all about them. Those of us who are on the inside. It's all about their comfort, their enjoyment, their entertainment. And here is a favorite question I love to hear them asking one another after church as they're leaving. How did you like the service today? Did you enjoy it? Wasn't the pastor, he was good. I'd rate him about 7 on a 10-point scale today, not an 8 like last week, but he's doing okay, don't you think?
On a dangerous seacoast where shipwrecks often occur, there was once a crude little life-saving station. The building was just a hut, and there was only one boat. But the few devoted members kept a constant watch over the sea, and no thought for themselves, they went out day or night, tirelessly searching for the lost. Many lives were saved by this wonderful little station, so that it became famous. Some of those who were saved and various others in the surrounding areas wanted to become associated with the station and give it their time and money and effort for the support of its work. New boats were bought and new crews were trained. The little life-saving station grew. Some of the new members of the life-saving station were unhappy that the building was so crude and so poorly equipped. They felt that a more comfortable place should be provided as the first refuge of those saved from the sea. They replaced the emergency cots with beds and put better furniture in the enlarged building. Now the life-saving station became a popular gathering place for its members, and they redecorated it beautifully and furnished it as a sort of club. Less of the members were now interested in going to sea on life-saving missions, so they hired lifeboat crews to do this work. The mission of life-saving was still given lip service, but most were too busy or lacked the necessary commitment to take part in the life-saving activities personally. About this time, a large ship was wrecked off the coast, and the hired crews brought in boatloads of cold, wet, and half-drowned people. They were dirty and sick. Some had skin of a different color. Some spoke a strange language, and the beautiful new club was considerably messed up. So the property committee immediately had a shower house built outside the club where victims of shipwrecks could be cleaned before coming inside. At the next meeting, there was a split in the club membership. Most of the members wanted to stop the club's life-saving activities as being unpleasant and a hindrance to the normal pattern of the club. But some members insisted that life-saving was their primary purpose and pointed out that they were still called a life-saving station, but they were finally voted down and told that if they wanted to save the life of all various kinds of people who were shipwrecked in those waters, they could begin their own life-saving station down the coast. They did. As the years went by, the new station experienced the same changes that had occurred in the old station. They evolved into a club, and yet another life-saving station was founded. If you visit the seacoast today, you will find a number of exclusive clubs along that shore. Shipwrecks are still frequent in those waters, but now most of the people drown.
I'd like to invite the worship team back up. And as they're coming, I want to talk to you just about a few seconds as Jerry. I'm not the devil anymore, okay? That parable has haunted me for 40 years. I first came across that parable, I think, when I was at seminary, and I don't think I've read it for 40 years, but as I was praying about this service today, God just brought it back into my mind, and I just kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And today, with the internet, you can find anything back on the internet that you lost in your file decades ago. And the message of that parable is basically this. Number one is number one because lost people matter to God. Lost people matter to God. If you look at the proportion in the parable of the 99, the shepherd left the 99 and he went in search of the one lost person. That tells me where God has put his priorities. I remember a few years ago when our next to the youngest daughter, through no fault of her own, got stranded out at Lucky Peak all night long. On the other side of the water, and she couldn't get back, and she couldn't call us because there was no phone service. You know what we did that night? We got out and we were looking for her. I'll never forget that night as we were driving around Lucky Peak trying to find our daughter. And I thought, what else really matters? I mean, and that's the kind of priority that God places upon lost people. And so my question to you is simply this. Are you living each day of your life with God's priorities? Are you waking up and saying, okay, Lord, what do you want me to do today? Who is it that I can connect with for your kingdom cause? Or are you just enjoying life in the club? That's really my question. And I'm praying that God will just open our eyes so that we can see what his priorities really are. Would you stand with me as we worship together for another moment?